Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Thomas Lindsay. He's an attorney and the executive director of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDF, a nonprofit law firm that has provided free legal services to over 500 local governments and nonprofit organizations since 1995. He's co-founder of the Daniel Pennock Democracy School, now taught in 24 states across the country, which has graduated over 5,000 lawyers, activists, and municipal officials, which assists groups to create new community campaigns, which elevate the rights of those communities over rights claimed by corporations. So, as always, Thomas, thank you for your work, and thank you for being on the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on the show.
Okay, so just in the past week or so, I read a decision by a judge in Colorado. He overturned a ban on fracking that had been voted in by the people of Fort Collins, Colorado. And he wrote, quote, "The city's five-year ban effectively eliminates the possibility of oil and gas development within the city. This is so because hydraulic fracturing is used in, quote, virtually all oil and gas wells, end quote, in Colorado. To eliminate a technology that is used in virtually all oil and gas wells would substantially impede the state's interest in oil and gas production," end quote. So there you have it. You know, neither protecting your drinking water from being poisoned nor any notion of community self-determination shall be allowed to impede oil and gas production. I find the whole thing pretty, well, I want to say stunning, but also completely expected. So can you comment on all this?
Yeah, I think the decision was completely expected, except for some environmental organizations like Food and Water Watch, who are working in Colorado, who aren't exactly upfront with people about the local enactments that they're working with them to put into place. But just to take a step back, because the Fort Collins decision that you read from is actually part of a bigger thing that's happening in Colorado right now. In Colorado, in those communities that have been faced with oil and gas extraction and fracking over the past several years, essentially the epicenter of oil and gas extraction in the state of Colorado, so like Weld County, the part of the state just north of Denver, that those communities are engaged currently in what I would term an open revolt, that they're saying we don't want fracking in our community. So it includes places like Fort Collins, which is the decision that you read, and places like Longmont, Colorado, and Lafayette, Colorado, and Colorado Springs, places that have stood up and said we're going to begin passing local laws to either regulate better or ban oil and gas extraction within those communities. And so various communities have gone forward past those ordinances. There's now been a series of court challenges. So in Fort Collins, again, from the decision that you read from, the people of Fort Collins put a five-year moratorium on oil and gas extraction occurring in their community. That was struck down by a judge. In Longmont, Colorado, the folks in Longmont banned oil and gas extraction within their community. That was struck down by the judge in Longmont. In the city of Lafayette, where we've been working, who passed a community bill of rights ordinance in the community to ban oil and gas extraction within the community, they were also sued. And the plaintiff in most of these actions is the Colorado Oil and Gas Association. So it's the trade industry for the oil and gas companies that operate in Colorado. What's fascinating about what's occurred is that, you know, you've always had communities that stand up and say, we want to say no to this particular thing coming in. Could be cyanide use and disposal, which is an issue in Colorado as well. Factory farms, you know, land application of sludge, corporate water withdrawals, use of genetically modified seeds and foods, fracking, basically all these thousands of single issues that communities are faced with every day. You've always had communities standing up to say no. What happens when they stand up and say no in a relatively unsophisticated way, which is to say we don't want it and we're going to pass this ordinance, which is in effect a one-paragraph thing saying we don't want it here, that it's very easy for the industry and for the corporations to come in and use the courts and say, hey, our corporate rights are worth more than community rights or right to safe drinking water and right to environmental protection, those types of things. In other words, to elevate their rights above the rights of the community. What's different about what's happening in Colorado now is you of course, have Longmont and Fort Collins who have taken the easy approach, which is, in essence, to pass an ordinance saying we want to say no to this thing. But you have other communities like Lafayette who have adopted something called a community bill of rights, working with us that essentially says the community has a constitutional right to not only say no to the oil and gas extraction, whatever the project is that's coming in, but also a right to govern their own community, to say yes to sustainable energy policies and yes to sustainable agricultural policies. In essence, local control that's wide enough and heavy enough to actually carry this transformation from an unsustainable society to a sustainable one, and actually to challenge the doctrines that are in place within the system that normally prevent the community from moving in that direction. So instead of just Longmont and Fort Collins as examples, where people have just said no to oil and gas extraction, Lafayette has instead, the people of Lafayette have said no, but they've also challenged the very authority of the state to preempt them from doing so, and have also challenged the authority of corporations to use corporate rights to override them. So, for example, in the city of Lafayette's local enactment that the people there passed by 60% last year, they said no oil and gas extraction, but also they have a right to clean air and clean water and a right to a sustainable energy future. And in addition, they've said that any permits issued by the state that violate those rights in their community bill of rights is not valid. In other words, they've said that the state can't preempt whatever the community wants to do in terms of stopping these corporate projects. And then as a final ticker on the end, they've said corporations, oil and gas corporations, don't have certain rights within the community that the oil and gas corporations can use to override what they've passed. And so what happens, a lot of this sometimes sounds like legal gobbledygook, but it's not. It's the fact that when you have people going to the voting box, when you have people going to the voting place to cast their ballot, you have people voting not just on saying no to oil and gas extraction, but you have people voting to change the structure of law under which they operate, to actually cast a vote to say that we have a right to local self-government here, that the state government can't override and that corporate rights can't nullify. So you have a movement of a democratic majority moving forward. That's what's been harnessed in places like Lafayette, is people moving forward to say, it's not enough to say no to these things because our no is not recognized under the current system of law. We actually have to dismantle those doctrines like preemption and corporate rights that normally control what we can or cannot do within our community. So when I say it's expected that you get the Fort Collins ruling where the judge says, you know, we're sorry, but state law preempts you and the state's interest in oil and gas extraction is much more important than yours at the local level, we should expect those decisions. We should expect to be hauled into court. We should expect for those doctrines to be applied. And if we know that that's going to happen down the road, we need to actually change our organizing and activism so that we're actually passing something different than what we know is automatically going to be struck down. That we actually have to involve people in a different conversation about how much the system has to change to give breathing space to these local communities that actually want to stop these corporate projects from moving forward. And that's why all this always seems very complex, but in some ways it's very straightforward. It's actually about aligning the law itself with the direction that the community wants to move in terms of how they want to see their own community governed.
So I obviously agree with everything you're saying, but I'm a little bit confused. And that's, what's to stop a judge or several judges from saying the same thing to Lafayette? That why can't they say, which, by the way, I grew up just not very far from Lafayette. I don't know if you know that.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I grew up just in east of Boulder, west of Louisville. So I grew up probably 4 or 5 miles from Lafayette. What's to stop a judge from saying, well, you can say that those permits aren't valid, but tough luck for you, they are. And you can say that you want rights to clean air, but tough luck for you because the state's interests preempt that. What's to stop a judge from just overruling the Lafayette one just like they overrule the others?
Well, the short answer is nothing. But what the framework does, the organizing theory and the organizing structure, is actually call it out, which we have not done over the past 100 years as activists and organizers. we accept the status of preemption and corporate rights and all that kind of stuff, and then we try to move within it. That's what the major environmental organizations have done. They've said, we accept that we can't change the doctrine of preemption. We accept that we can't change the corporate rights doctrine. But we're going to conform our activism within those boundaries. That's in essence why communities stand up and say no in a very short and simple way, and then somehow expect the courts to rule differently against them using preemption and corporate rights doctrine. What this work is about is actually bringing it all out into the open. Everything's camouflaged. The way the system actually functions in the United States is so camouflaged that very few people actually understand how it functions. What this work is about is bringing out those doctrines into the open. So forcing a judge, for example, not just to overturn the ordinance if that's their inclination, but to say that of course corporate rights are more important than the rights of the community. And of course the community lacks the authority to actually redefine corporate rights within their locality. And of course the state has preemptive authority. And of course the locality's interests are not important. In other words, to pull that out, because right now people don't understand how the system operates. They don't understand what the preemption doctrine is about. They don't understand what corporate rights are about. And the broader organizing strategy is, once that system, once that confrontation evolves and matures, and people see how it works, that they understand the need to change it. And the change in Colorado has emerged in the form of something called the Colorado Community Rights Network. So there are various localities and communities now joining together underneath the umbrella of this Colorado Community Rights Network. And the Colorado Community Rights Network this past year actually proposed a state constitutional amendment that would override preemption for certain purposes within communities and explicitly allow communities to do local lawmaking that recognizes the rights of ecosystems and the rights of the community to say no to certain corporate projects coming in. But there's no way to actually build support or heft underneath that constitutional amendment unless people understand what the problem is. And the problem is not oil and gas extraction. The problem is not fracking. The problem is that we're stuck in a system of law that guarantees that state authority will be placed behind the corporations who do oil and gas extraction and fracking. That the state system of law is actually written by those very corporations that ostensibly that system of law is supposed to regulate. What we're seeking is structural change in how the system actually operates. We're not trying to just build an exception here or there for a community to be able to say no to a specific corporate project, but an understanding that people within these communities have a right, a constitutional right, to local self-government, to actually make decisions in those communities about what those communities look like in 40, 50, 60 years. The litigation stuff is a stepping stone to make people understand how the system actually functions, so that higher change can occur. Because if people don't understand how the system functions, they automatically believe we live in a democracy, and that democracy is defined by corporate rights and preemption and these other doctrines that have been put into place. This is about, in essence, ripping the veil off people's eyes so that people understand that we don't live in a democracy. We live in something much different. And if we don't live in a democracy, then we need to create one. And the way to create it is to go to those state and federal change agents to begin driving state constitutional changes and federal constitutional changes that will actually change the structure so that we're not fighting with one hand tied behind our backs anymore, that we're actually in a cohesive strategy that gives rise to a movement, and it's that movement that begins to fundamentally restitch and create a new system of law that allows our communities to actually govern themselves. To me, at least, it's the only path towards sustainability other than a complete collapse of the system and a rebuilding of it, which, you know, may be possible as well, may even be probable. But at this point, the fact is, if communities can't make key decisions about what happens within them, by default, those decisions are being made by corporate officials that are 3,000 miles away from the communities that are affected by their decisions. And in addition, because corporations have First Amendment rights and lobbying rights and the ability to elect officials, that they are controlling state policy. And so as long as we're stuck within that system in which corporations have rights that override ours and that they can use the state at will to actually put into place state statutes that override whatever substantive laws that we want to pass at the local level, sustainability becomes impossible. There's no way to attain it because decisions have been displaced from the community affected by those activities and actually placed somewhere else. And as long as we're within that system, within that structure, which is not democratic, there's absolutely no way for communities to move towards sustainability. And so that's the stopper. And so the question is, how do we build a movement that actually takes that on in an environment in which everybody's been so dumbed down that very few people actually understand how the system works? The actual, you know, the tendons that are stitched throughout the system that actually make it function. People don't understand that they're under the thumb of those tendons. And so this is about displaying them for people to see and then actually using that display to radicalize people enough so that they begin to work towards fundamental state and federal change.
See, one of the things that I've loved about your work for how long have we known each other now? 23, 24 years or something?
Yeah, way back from Spokane.
Yeah. So one of the things I've always loved about your work is that, you know, you can argue in court and you can do all these things, and your tactic is really a fundamental revolutionary tactic. And I'm thinking of the classic revolutionary thing where you attempt to provoke a conflict with the state in order to show that the state is repressive. And a lot of times when we think about that, we think about, you know, the revolutionaries, you know, blowing something up or something like that in order to show that the state is inherently repressive and to have the state overreact. And this is just something that it makes me laugh almost every time I think about your work, is that you're doing the exact same thing, except you're throwing a lawsuit, you know, or you're throwing an ordinance, or what you're doing is you're setting out to expose the, I don't want to say contradictions because they aren't contradictions, but instead you expose the workings, the mechanisms of the state through these incendiary acts of litigation and these incendiary acts of democracy is really what we're talking about. And I just think that's fabulous.
One of the ways we talk about it internally is how do we draw controlled confrontations? In other words, on our ground, on our platform. And so we work with communities to assume that communities have local self-government, because after all, that's what most people think. If you tell people that living in your own municipality or community that you don't have the authority to govern your community, most people think you're crazy. You know, because most people think we live in a democracy and we have all these layers of government and we can make those decisions through those layers. But when you start screwing around with some of the fundamental stuff like energy and agriculture and transportation and those big ticket items, what you find is that they've been taken away from us over the years. We've been divested almost completely of any decision-making authority over those items. And they've been centralized higher and higher up the chain. So the agribusiness corporations, they don't want to be dependent upon local communities who may be able to say no to genetically modified seeds. And so what you've seen across the United States is over 20 state legislatures being used by the agribusiness corporations to drive preemptive laws that say communities can't write regulations or control or ban genetically modified seed use within their communities. And that's no different from factory farms. Almost all states have a right to farm law, which includes corporate agribusiness within its protections, so that localities can't pass laws that actually try to regulate factory farms, for example. And so the reality of the situation is much different than what people imagine in their heads. What people imagine in their heads is that there's all kinds of remedies. We can do this, this, and this. But when they actually attempt to exercise those remedies, they run into walls. And so the other phrase we use is, you know, we help communities exhaust imagined remedies. So they try different remedies. They don't work. People begin to understand that the system itself is something that's been misrepresented to them. And so they decide to try different things, which is one of the primary things we talk with communities about, is that it's time to stop asking for what we can get within the current system, which may be very, very little, and instead begin demanding what we want. So what do we actually want? Well, we want sustainable agricultural systems. Okay, so let's write that into law. It's what some communities in Oregon are doing now. This is what a sustainable agricultural system looks like. It doesn't have factory farms, doesn't have corporate ownership over farms, doesn't have GMOs. has a right to sell and buy local food within the community, which is something that's being interfered with now by USDA regulations and federal and state laws. So what does it look like? Let's talk about what a sustainable agricultural system looks like, and let's use the law to actually codify that. Let's use the law to actually obtain it. It's a way we haven't thought of in, you know, many, many years of activism, whereas the corporations on the other side, that's all they do, is they say, how do we use the law to actually, you know, make our profit margins bigger? How do we use the law to actually define the type of agriculture that we want to do? And so it's a revolution, I think, not just in lawmaking and in litigation and those other things, although I think that's important too. It's a revolution in the way we think. It's a revolution in the way that we act. It's a revolution in the way that we see our activism. And it's unfortunate, but the major environmental organizations, I've come to the conclusion, are as big a threat as the corporations that we face. Because the corporations, at least, put their cards on the table. They say, we want to do X, and you don't have any right to stop us. Okay, that's pretty clear when that happens. But the major environmental groups come in and say, we want to help you. And so the community says, well, we want your help. And the environmental group says, okay, well, if you want our help, we'll appeal this permit to this level agency and then appeal it again to this administrative agency and then appeal it again to the courts. And it's all within the structure of the regulatory law that's been written by the very corporations that ostensibly the regulatory laws are supposed to regulate. And so by not being revolutionary about changing the mode of activism, the major environmental groups are simply validating the system that we have. They're validating preemption. They're validating corporate rights. They're validating the relationship of the community and the municipality as having zero rights to the state's rights, which are superior. You validate all of that stuff by not calling it out, by not challenging it directly and openly. And that's what the major environmental groups have gotten good at. They've gotten good at doing that kind of work and raising money from it. And so they've become as big a problem at this point. You know, groups like Food and Water Watch and the major environmental organizations in the United States that do the permit appeals, you know, NRDC and EDF and all the big groups that sop up hundreds of millions of dollars each year. And in doing so, they validate the same crap that's put us in the same position where we were 40 years ago. You know, and after the major environmental laws have been passed, 40 years later, we're in worse situation now than we were before those environmental laws were passed by almost every major environmental statistic. So it's time to stop. I mean, I know I'm preaching to the converted here, but it's time to stop it all and actually begin to focus on the stuff that matters, which is instead of playing by the rules that someone else has written, it's finally time to actually write our own and then to challenge all the hurdles and obstacles that are put in our way that stop us from doing what we need to do, because those hurdles are artificial. They've been put there on purpose by someone else to stop us from doing exactly what we need to do. So our work is confrontational, it's controversial, it's intended to be all those things, it's frontal, it's direct, it's about challenging everything that stops communities from actually being able to protect themselves using the law.
So here is a concern I have about local governance, and it is that the community that I live in, I love the forests here, and the politics are, I often call this Mississippi on the North Coast. If the locals had their way, there wouldn't be a tree standing. And the local, I don't know if you know much about the secessionist movement in Northern California and Southern Oregon, but there are, I think, 5 counties in Northern California that want to secede. And I actually agree with some of their stuff. They don't want their water stolen for Southern California. I completely agree with that. But a lot of it is like the sheriff is one of the heads of the secessionist movement here. And he has openly called environmentalists the enemy. And I know that if it weren't for federal protection here locally, and you know me, and you know how much I want to bring the whole system down. That's not in question here, but that doesn't alter the fact that if the locals had their say, probably locally they would. Oh, for God's sake! One of the local supervisors actually wrote an essay complaining that white people can no longer call African Americans colored. And so you see where I'm going with this, right?
Sure.
And so, what do you do with that? This is something that I've not figured out for myself, and I've talked to a lot of bioregionalists who have the same concern. What do you do with the fact that, yes, we want local control, but in some places, local control would basically mean some really, really nasty things. Even I know that part of the answer is, well, we're already getting nasty things. You know, how much more nasty can you get than fracking and factory farms? But that still doesn't, that still, my question still remains.
Yeah. Our work, when we talk about community rights, is not about secession. It's not about, taking a saw and actually cutting, physically or metaphysically the community off from the rest of the United States. The community rights work that we do recognizes that there are boundaries on what communities can legislate. And those two boundaries, are roughly defined as a rights boundary and a standards boundary. So what do those mean? Well, the rights boundary is the easiest one. If you're a citizen of the United States, you are a citizen of your locality, you're a citizen of your state, and you're a citizen of the federal government. As a citizen of the federal government, you have federal constitutional rights. Those are both in the Bill of Rights as well as in other portions of the Constitution. As a resident of the state, you're protected by the state Bill of Rights. So you have state Bill of Rights, and you have rights contained in other parts of the state constitution. At the local level, if you have a local constitution, a local charter for your community, then you're protected by those rights as well. You possess those rights within that local charter. Your sum mass as a citizen is, in essence, your federal rights, your state rights, and your local rights. And it's the most expansive rights of those three that actually govern what rights you have, which are legally enforceable. So, for example, if your state government tried to take away your First Amendment rights, they can't because the federal government constraints apply. So when somebody would say, okay, well, what First Amendment free speech rights do you have? You would say, I have federal Bill of Rights protections. Even if the state constitution has tried to limit those, it can't under our system of law because the rights that you have that you can exercise are the broadest possible under those three levels of enactment. So at the community level, the community rights work that we do is not about communities actually taking rights away, because communities can't, under our system of law constitutionally, diminish the rights that you hold within the state constitutional framework or within the federal constitutional framework. The only thing the localities can do is expand rights out. That's why you see in our enactments a right to clean water, right to clean air, things that don't exist within the state or federal enactments. But it's constitutionally impossible for a locality operating under that individual rights scheme to actually diminish rights from individual people that live within those communities. I think that's pretty well understood at this point in the community rights framework. What you're talking about is the standards argument, which is if federal law contains standards for environmental protection or state law contains standards for environmental protection, can localities diminish those standards for environmental protection? And the answer is, at least in our enactments under the community rights theory, is no. So when the Colorado Community Rights Network put forward their state constitutional amendment this year, it said that localities couldn't diminish those standards or protections that otherwise exist in state statutes or federal statutes for the natural environment and for people, for labor. I mean, different environmental and civil rights statutes that might exist at the state or federal level that afford a level of protection and standard setting for those populations or for the natural environment would prevail. And so this isn't about setting communities adrift. It's not about putting them on an ice floe and setting them off in the middle of the ocean. It's a question of actually defining the relationship between communities, the state level and the federal level, in such a way so it's a race to the top. In other words, not a race to the bottom where the challenge is to find out how you can de minimis or minimize certain environmental protections or people's rights, but instead a race to the top at which the protections that are held in place or the rights that are held in place are actually governed by those most expansive pronouncement of either rights or standards contained within state, federal, and local law. Now, given that, it means that the hose only runs one way. That, in other words, state and federal government can set foundations, they can set basements, but they can't set ceilings. And what's interesting is that's been the relationship between state and federal rights for the past 150 years. that just because the federal government has certain protections or rights in place, there's nothing that says the states can't exceed those rights or protections. What we're seeking to do is take that same relationship between the federal and the state and apply it to the state and the local, so that the local is actually included in that conversation, so that the local can expand protections and expand rights while having people and the natural environment protected by the standards and rights that have been passed into effect at the state and federal level. So it's not about secession. It's not about setting the community loose. It's about defining a relationship that actually allows people within their own communities to make law that's more protective of either individual civil and political rights or individual environmental protections, labor protections, civil rights protections, anti-discrimination protections. That's the structure under which this organizing proceeds.
So would corporate boosters pretty much agree with the analysis, except that instead of saying that there should be that communities can't have, okay, you're saying that communities can only have greater rights for greater human rights and non-human rights than the state or federal level will give. And wouldn't they say, or couldn't they say, that they would completely agree with that, except that, of course, corporations are people, and so a community should not be able to make it so there are this person called a corporation does not have the same rights in Lafayette as it does in Niwot?
It's a great question, and it comes down to the community rights theory, you know, which has evolved to a point where we file this community rights framework theory with the courts. In fact, we just did in the Lafayette action in Colorado. That part of the community rights structure is about recognizing that rights only accrue to people, that rights only accrue to natural persons, that rights can't accrue to property. Because as insane as it sounds, that's like recognizing that your refrigerator has rights and that your refrigerator could sue communities for interfering with those rights. A corporation is property under the law. It can be bought and sold or owned. It is a piece of property. So we've gotten so used to thinking of corporations as other things, and in some ways they've been treated as persons. They've been anthropomorphized, or whatever the word is, and they've been given human traits. So we think about corporations as something more than they are, but corporations are property. Property is incapable of holding rights. You may have the right to own a piece of property, which is a completely different thing. You can own a refrigerator. But under our system of law, a corporation as property has been given rights by our system. So by the courts, and some would say by Congress and legislatures, they've actually recognized property as having rights. And so under our community rights theory, property is incapable of possessing rights. It's a non sequitur. That rights are for people, but not for property. So property is incapable of holding rights. So under this system, you know, when our communities say corporations do not have certain rights, or oil and gas extraction corporations don't have certain rights within the community, we're making a legal argument that property is incapable of possessing rights. And certainly, to the extent that not only is property incapable of possessing rights, but taking that to a logical conclusion, since they are incapable of holding rights, they can't elevate those rights over community rights. So when we talk about community rights, again, it's not just about setting loose a community to do whatever it wants. It's about finding a different relationship for that community within the federal system, where we have federal, state, and local levels of governance.
Okay, so obviously, once again, I completely agree with you. And when you make this argument to, I guess I'm going to ask three things. So first, when you say these things in private to somebody who is a pro-corporate lawyer or corporate booster, how would they respond? When you say this in public, how would they respond? And the third part of the question is, what are some of the most crazy or most revealing statements that you have had pro-corporate types say back to you that like just made your jaw drop. It's like, thank you so much for saying something so obviously anti-democratic.
I'm going to try to track those three, but remind me if I get off course.
Okay, first the private response, public response, anywhere you want. Private response.
Oh, the private response is you're crazy. That corporations have had rights for the past 200 years. In fact, corporate rights go all the way back to England, church corporations, educational institutions, that corporate rights are so ingrained in the English system of law that to even raise the issue is sanctionable in the courts. In other words, that you can be hit with money damages for even raising the concept that corporations should not be persons under the law. And so privately, they go ballistic. They say, you know, you're wasting our time and making this argument is insane. It, in fact, shocks the conscience. You know, in the legal arena, you have this phrase called shocks the conscience, which is intended for a judge to order punitive damages against you to punish you for making certain arguments in the court. So, you know, they'll use that phrase, that the argument that corporations are not persons under the law and therefore shouldn't have rights under the law, that shocks the conscience of the court and of the litigators and therefore is sanctionable. And so we've had, you know, this crawls over into the other question, but we've had sanctions motions brought against us to say that even raising the argument that corporations should not have rights is actually sanctionable by the courts. I mean, just to show you how deeply this stuff has actually been ingrained. We've been able to get statements from lawyers on the other side who say things like corporate rights are the foundation of liberty and progress in the United States, that without protection of the corporate form, that we would not have capitalism, that we would not have the economic production system that we have, which produces liberty and happiness, that they're all tied together, that this is all about progress. And if you attack corporate rights, you're actually attacking progress and liberty and happiness and God and apple pie and everything else. In addition, we've had the state attorney general office in Pennsylvania wrote a brief one time where, you know, first point in the brief was people, you know, the people of the community have no right to local self-government. that there's no right to local self-government, which technically under the law is true. But here's, you know, talk about pulling it out, pulling the camouflage away. Imagine being a community member. You know, it's not Tom Lindsay or Ben Price or one of the other people from the Legal Defense Fund coming in to say to you that you have no right to local self-government. This is the Attorney General of the state filing a brief, argument one, number one at the very beginning, there is no right to community local self-government. So sometimes getting the court to say it, even though we, you know, we're telling people it, we're, you know, who's going to believe us? We're just a small organization running around. But when a judge says it, or when the Attorney General's office says it, when a position of authority actually says it, then we can use it and people will listen to it because we're trained to listen to authority figures. And so it goes a long way towards proving. And a lot of our work is just about proof. It's about proving to people that we don't live in a democracy, proving to people that we don't have a system that recognizes our ability to govern ourselves at the community level. And instead of us trying to convince people of that, sometimes it's much quicker and carries much more weight for the court to say it, or for the attorney general to say it, or for a panel of judges to say it, or for people to see an oral argument where the judges are actually accepting the fact that corporations have rights and that the state has the power to preempt localities. And so it's all about pulling it out, because when we don't pull it out, we assume it's all true. You know, silence is assent. So when the environmental organizations go in and say, well, the only activism we can do is appeal this permit on noise or setbacks or whatever else, they're assuming the way that the system operates to deliver the permit is all true. They're validating that entire system that delivers the permit on the end and tells people that their only option is to argue over setbacks or noise decibel level or any of these other crap things that you get to argue when you're in the regulatory process. And so this work is about, you know, question number three that you asked, this work is actually about pulling that stuff out, because whatever they can give us, we need. And in this, we're in a lawsuit in New Mexico right now where the Independent Petroleum Producers Association has sued over an oil and gas extraction ban that we helped Mora County, New Mexico pass. First in the state of New Mexico. And the executive director of the Independent Petroleum Producers Association came out with a statement He said that our work, the community rights work, was a game changer for corporate America. You know, that it wasn't just about oil and gas, that it's about everything, because it's about bringing all the issues back together again, a common denominator, to say that there's no difference between logging, you know, unsustainable logging and water withdrawal or fracking or factory farms or landfill sludge or any of the other stuff that we face. They can all, because it doesn't matter what we want. It doesn't matter what we want in terms of sustainable forestry. It doesn't matter what we want in terms of sustainable agriculture. It doesn't matter what we want in terms of sustainable energy, because we can want all we want within our communities, but if we don't have the actual legal authority to get it, it doesn't matter. If we can't write laws to actually secure that, it doesn't matter. And so we need to seize that power to actually begin to deal with those issues of importance. And we can't do that until we create a movement of people who actually understand what the problem is. That the problem is not these single issues. The problem is the fact that we don't even have the authority to govern our own communities anymore. And until we change that structure, it doesn't matter what we want those other issues to be.
So we have about 5 minutes left, and I have a couple questions left. One of them is, so I mentioned earlier that you and I have first met, I think it was 24 years ago now, or 23 or something. And, you know, in that time, obviously, the physical situation in the world has gotten much, much worse. And would you say that the awareness of the issues that you have been working on, has the awareness of exactly what you're trying to help people to understand, has it gotten better? Has it gotten worse? Has it stayed fundamentally the same? I'm not talking about physical conditions now. I'm talking about the social understanding of some of the messages that you've been trying to impart.
It's gotten better, but it's painfully slow.
Is that your whole answer? It's okay.
That's
if
my whole answer. It's painfully slow because it comes one person at a time.
Uh-huh.
I mean, think about how much an individual person has to go through before they come to the realization that they have to fundamentally change their activism and do something
right.
completely different.
Yeah.
And so we pick up small bunches of people at a time, you know, so 10 people in Colorado and 10 people in New Hampshire and 10 people in other places. The system is exceedingly complex. I mean, just to understand what Dillon's rule is, or preemption, or corporate constitutional rights and how they actually operate, you almost have to be doing it full time. It has to be relevant to you, and you have to be in the middle of it. So, you know, as stuff changes and people are able to hear this message, you know, there's no mass conversion. It's basically people coming in the door as, you know, refugees from the major environmental organizations or refugees from conventional organizing, or people that gave up organizing several, you know, many years ago and are now coming back to it. Those are the people that we look for.
You know, it reminds me of a couple things. One of them is that, you know, I read somewhere a long time ago that it takes 10 years to change your mind. And the guy who wrote that was writing this essay about how he had been completely anti-choice, and then with no discernible transition, suddenly 10 years later he found himself arguing just as vociferously pro-choice. And so I thought about that, and I've thought about that a lot. And I know for myself that years and years ago, I read John Livingston, who wrote a bunch of great things. One of which is he didn't believe that evolution is based on competition primarily, but on cooperation. And when I first read that, I was thinking, God, he's crazy. And then probably it was 3 or 4 years later, I could no longer conceptualize how anybody could believe that evolution is based primarily on competition. You know, I'd had that.
Right.
And I did. This is one reason I don't actually get in arguments with people, is because I plant seeds, and then, you know, a few years later it might change. And one more story having to do with this, which is not a very nice thing, but it's how change happens with me. When I was a teenager, it was very common to use the word fag. And that was just a generic, you know, you'd say it to a friend of yours if they missed a basketball shot. And I was faced with the awfulness of that word one day when I was trying to teach a bisexual friend of mine how to drive a car, a stick shift, and he ran my car into a pole, and I called him a fag, and he said, yeah, but what's that have to do with me driving your car into a pole? And I suddenly realized that this is not just some generic three letters, but instead this word is hate speech. And here's the point. Did I stop using that word immediately? No. It took me about a year, you know, even after a friend of mine confronted me about it and I realized how terrible it is. It's still on such a stupid thing. It took me a year to change my terrible behavior. So my point, I'm just validating what you were saying, that with all these examples, it takes people a long time to decolonize. Once you've had these terrible things inside of you, it takes a long time to change on a personal level.
Yes, which is, you know, in some ways, you know, I gave up on traditional, conventional environmental activists. We don't work with most of the major environmental groups anymore. I'd rather take 5 hours of time and spend it with a new community activist who's a first-time activist going through stuff for the first time and coming to their own conclusions about it, rather than someone who's been through the regulatory stuff for so many years that it clouds their judgment and ability to actually approach something new. But we do get people coming in through those doors, and people have been through the ringer and are now say, this is crap, and we need to do something else. So it's one person at a time. It's actual real hard critical thinking, which has been blasted out of most of us by the educational process and everything else. And it's about figuring out that if we don't do something different, then we're all screwed. This place is cooked. And so I think as things from a physical condition get worse, it also begins to push people in our direction.
So I want to say two things. One of them is that I do want to mention about the use of that horrible word, that after I did stop using it, I obviously haven't used it again. I just wanted to make that clear to listeners that, you know, it took me a while, but then I got it. But then the other thing I want to say to close up our conversation for today is, so people hear this, and what do you want them to do? They live in Fruta, Colorado,
mm-hmm.
or somewhere.
Well, if they're in certain states, there's a whole network for them to patch into. So in Colorado, it's the Colorado Community Rights Network. Those folks are waiting to embrace you if you live in Colorado. In other places, it's being connected to different communities where we're working, or for better than that, actually doing the work in their own community. So if there's an issue that they're facing, that community rights could actually be the framework under which they move forward, then we're more than willing to help them to work through that process. And easiest way to get in touch with us is through our webpage. So that's celdef.org, CELD as in David, F as in Frank.org, stands for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund.
So thank you so much for your work, Thomas, and thank you for being on the program.
Yes, thanks for having us back on the show.
And I would like to thank listeners very much for listening. My guest today has been Thomas Lindsay. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.